welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where this week we're asking, where else can you show art? For established galleries, finding a city spot to show your new work isn't necessarily a problem, but for those who are just getting started, hiked up rents in all the best neighbourhoods means that putting on a show isn't always so easy. We're seeing increasing amounts of art shows being held in weird and wonderful places, and today's Whistle Stop Tour will take us out of the square, white-walled universe of normality to visit a few alternative spaces where people have pitched up and put on a show. We'll be going from a New York elevator shaft to the back alleys of Belgrade via the comfort of a South London home, and we'll buzz along the American phone line system, all in the name of art. And that is all coming up on Culture, right here with me, Robert Bound. We're going to begin today's show in Belgrade. Serbia's capital is a city in which the main public galleries have failed. Both the National Museum and the Museum of Contemporary Arts have been closed for more than a decade apiece in renovation projects that have gone horribly wrong and denied the public any chance to view the impressive collections of international art and the best works from the former Yugoslavia. But there is hope. The past few years have seen a boom in small city centre art spaces, which are giving artists somewhere to show and develop their works. And of course, the public have the chance to satisfy their cultural needs. You just need to know where to look. And fortunately, our Belgrade correspondent Guy Delaunay can sniff out a gallery, even if it's tucked down a dark alley.
It's a windy Friday evening in mid-October in Belgrade. And if you just walk through Nikola Pašić Square, down the back you'll find an alley which has got some bunting flying between some concrete pillars, and here's a crowd of a few dozen people all standing outside some illuminated display cases with some extremely striking black and white photographic prints on them. And this is one of Belgrade's newest but already best loved artistic institutions, Street Gallery.
I'm Radomir from the Collective Ministry of Space. We are having here a gallery, Street Gallery of Belgrade, which is an open-air gallery in the rundown street in the city center, which is basically some sort of a secret place because city center is all fancy and shit, and this is, well, not so fancy.
It's an alley, isn't it?
Let's be honest. Alley, everybody take a piece here, so it's a struggle between urinal and art and culture. It's been a really lively 4 years for us, and we managed to do every 2 weeks a new exhibition.
But the interesting thing about Street Gallery is it's reusing what's left of a burnt-out cinema here.
Yes, because we are like on a ruins of the big Yugoslavian culture here, because one of the most important cinema was on this place, and these walls that we are having pictures shown on is one of the walls of the cinema which used to display like posters of next shows and stuff like that. And it was all completely ruined, and then we renovated, reconstructed it, and now we are using it as an open-air gallery.
This is a graffiti event at Ozone Gallery. Belgrade's top street artists are here, but anyone with the nerve to pick up a brush, stencil, or spray can is welcome to join in. Ozone has been open for more than a decade, and it's now onto its third location, on the second floor of an apartment block in the middle of the old town. It might be a little less obvious than a street-level gallery, but founder Nebojša Babić is determined to see the positive side.
It's good for the art to move from the streets, not to be on the knees in front of the masses, because the mass is not interested in the art. The big galleries and the museums, they're dinosaurs. Every city in the world needs that kind of format, that these small galleries, that experimental, that these kind of small playgrounds that you can make experiments. Here you can play, you can make mistakes. In museums and the big galleries, national galleries, mistakes are not allowed. But from the mistakes, you can make something different. And you can make this unexpected movement.
If you want to see art in Belgrade, You're going to have to seek it out, and in this case, negotiate a rather treacherous staircase down from one of the main boulevards in Belgrade city centre until you arrive at the U10 art space. And inside, an exhibition just opened previous evening, and it's a collaboration between the Sarajevo artist Maja Beganovic and Zoran Pantelic, who's from Belgrade. And there are even some works which are painted directly onto bubble wrap, and you're free to pop the bubbles.
We started with in 2012 with a project of having some space, maybe like project space, maybe for 3 or 4 months from the beginning. That was the idea. But now we are here more than 4 years.
Lydia Delic is one of the 7 artists who founded the U10 Gallery.
There is a lot of new artists which really wants to work on their works and on their projects and to travel and to bring someone here to have many collaboration. And it doesn't matter that museums are closed now. We are in that situation like in for 10 years now, so we need to look further to see what we really going to do without or with museum.
The ongoing closure of the main national institutions may have provided an opportunity for alternative spaces like U10, but Lydia's colleague Isadora Kristic warns that it's also a cultural crisis.
Who are the next generations who will come and be our visitors if they're not brought up to go to museums and have this regular culture? So I think it's a much wider problem in a sense.
But there's also a more optimistic interpretation. Another U10 partner, Maria Šević, says the past few years have brought positive changes.
In last few months, many new spaces has been opened, and it's independent spaces and private galleries, and I think that people are willing for the culture and for the scene, and the situation is changing, and it's really good.
The band plays on at the latest street gallery opening party, and the national galleries remain closed. In other words, it's business as usual on the Belgrade cultural scene. But whether it's in a back alley, an apartment, or at the bottom of a treacherous staircase, art is still alive and kicking. For Monocle in Belgrade, I'm Guy Delaunay.
Thanks, Guy. We're going to go from Belgrade back alley to one in New York now for our second story. When curator Alex Kalman was searching for a space in 2012 to house his museum collection, he never imagined the final destination would be in an abandoned elevator shaft down a near-deserted cobbled street. But the space has become an integral part of viewing his collection of things, a Pamuk-like array of everyday objects, from a group of items that security officers thought might be disguised explosives to a commemoration of the major events of 2015 in the form of biscuits. The collections are as jarring as the space itself, which measures about 4.5 square metres. Although the elevator, now defunct, no longer transports passengers, the 3 walls are packed with so much information that stepping inside feels like entering a different dimension. The space is called Museum, that's with 4 M's if you're Googling it, and Monocle's Clarissa Farr dropped in to find out more.
Enter the object's reference number at any time.
Let's say humanity disappeared and everything that we were holding or using just kind of like fell on the ground and got left behind and covered by dust. And 100 years from now, some alien anthropology force comes by and tries to re-piece together how we lived and who we were. This is what their museum might look like. So these are a mixture of everyday objects, but also strange interpretations of everyday objects and inventions that come out of sheer necessity for a person in a very specific situation. So these are the modern natural history museum of the present moment.
My name is Jacob Ford, and I'm one of the docents here, and I was the assistant producer at Museum for season 5. Each shelf tends to be its own collection, often from the same person who collects interesting objects that are all related in some way. And then each object has its own story, which is referenced by the number underneath each object. And if you dial our phone number on your phone, you can type in that number and hear its story.
How would you say that this space influences the art that you exhibit, or you know, influences your choices?
It helps people get in the right frame of mind for looking at the objects we show. So in the same way that some of our objects might be things that you see every day or even use every day, and now suddenly they're in a museum and you are analyzing them as if they're important in a way that you never considered them, here you are walking through an alley with a bunch of trash and you see a museum. So the way you discover the very space, whether or not you're looking for it, is the same way we want you to discover the objects that are in the museum.
Why do you think that's important?
The same reason we have four M's in our name, just gets people looking twice at something that they never thought to look at even once. A lot of these objects came from previous collections that we had. So there's a Pfizer fan and an OxyContin novelty wrench. These are both little novelty toys that pharmaceutical companies give out to doctors to promote their products. So last year we had a whole shelf full of these. We've just kept two around as a little reminder of the types of things we used to have.
Wow, and then we have our Trump.
Yes, so this is a collection that has become of increasing significance here in museum, but these are all Trump memorabilia, starting with his book, The Art of the Comeback, and then we have Trump Natural Spring Water, which was handed out in the lobbies of his hotels, Trump Energy Drink, Trump Vodka, and Trump Aftershave Balm, all short-lived, I believe, though maybe some of them are making a comeback, all the way to Trump Castle 3, which is a video game that shipped on four floppy disks in the 90s.
Wow. When did this shelf go up?
These were all collected by a reporter named Max Abelson. He did a series of stories on Trump in the early 2000s, and I think still writes about him now that he's back in action. Out of his reporting, he started collecting Trump objects and memorabilia and strange things from his stores, whether they were licensed or not. And he was kind enough to lend his collection to us. So this is Future Aleppo. This is our second wing, or our northern wing, Museum 2. This is a little piece of a much larger model that Mohammed Katish built of Aleppo. He is a 14-year-old architect in the city, though we just found out that he and his family have fled to Turkey. And this is his dream of what Aleppo might look like after it's rebuilt, or at least one quarter of it. So there are four panels here with paper buildings, kind of showing a mix of new developments and old parts of the city that he thinks should be rebuilt. And he always puts a park in the center of every city that he designs. It all started with a reporter named Wad Al-Khatib. She did a video piece on Muhammad in Aleppo, and we were able to see that video piece. And then through a series of connections involving a doctor who was willing to drive it across the border and some strange shipping arrangements, we were able to get one piece of the model here. And we got it all the way to this space, and then we tried to put it in and it didn't fit. So we had to rebuild the space a little bit to make it fit. But now that it's here, it's really beautiful.
So how many people come through here and see this in a week, would you say?
Typical Saturday or Sunday, I might average about 10 people an hour.
Can you tell me about some of the reactions that stand out?
My favorite are the people who think that I'm trying to scam them or sell something, so they don't come in. And if the more I try to invite them in, the more they run away. But it's about 50-50 between people who just walk through this alley and discover it on their own and people who saw it on the internet and really tried to find it.
My name's Stephen Curran. I live in Milford, Connecticut right now. I guess what's interesting is less the space, although it's on an amazing, cool alley, and it used to be an elevator of some type, probably a freight elevator. The space is sort of less important than the way they cram so much potential meaningful information into such a tiny space. And they did a nice job with the neon lighting, and so it's presentable. But you know, you have more than six people in there and you're really elbowing people and all, which is, I guess, part of the experience too, because somebody was getting out of my wife's way and he goes, excuse me, because he was reading the brochure. I guess this is part of the experience. And so it's probably an easier than most museums to strike up a conversation if that's what you wanted to do. But what's the cleverness of the way they curated this little exhibit was really cool. That's what makes it, I think, kind of special.
In the course of our lives, we find love, maybe. We experience hate, frustration, joy, optimism.
I mean, being located here in an alley with no big signs is part of the experience, that kind of stumbling upon.
Right. We like to think that we're a museum that came out of sheer necessity in this abandoned alley where people probably were looking to discover something. Or maybe they weren't, and now they did.
The symbols of our stories, of our thoughts, our needs, our desires, our hopes, and our fears.
That was Jacob Ford from Museum in New York speaking to Clarissa Farr. And you can find out more information at museum.com. Our next stop today is here in London, where one woman is running a gallery from her kitchen. Denison Baldwin-Smith is a writer and gallerist who's dedicated much of her life and career to indigenous art after spending vast amounts of time in the wilds of North America. This November sees her open up her very own gallery, which just so happens to be in her own Southeast London home, showing works by people from indigenous Canadian communities and artists who are inspired by the idea of home. Holly Fisher stayed south of the Thames to meet Denison and find out what it takes to open up your own house to art lovers.
When I started looking for potential spaces to rent, I realized that nothing that I could rent was either as big as or as beautiful as what I was already living inside of. And then I realized that this was perfectly in keeping with the ethos and intention of the gallery, which was about community rather than commodity, and was about the holding of a way of looking at art that has been preserved through Native communities, in which art is not an isolated phenomenon. It's not something that would ever simply exist in a white cube because it's constantly integrated. It's so integrated that most Native languages actually don't have a word for art. So art is home, it's what you live in, it's how you breathe, it's how you function in the world. It's the most organic thing that you can do. So then actually hosting the art and hosting the gallery in the home allows for that to happen. There's a little messiness about it. There's a imperfection about it that doesn't allow you to reify the art. It doesn't allow you to make it something other than what life is.
And how do you hope that people will interact with it in a different way to how they might if it was hung on the white walls of a gallery?
Well, I would hope that it's much more intimate. I would hope that it's something that they can more easily feel the spirit of the intention of the artist. I think that some of the ways in which they will respond differently has to do with how a person lives in space, and that they live in home in a really different way than they do when they walk into a shop front. So again, that you'd avoid the immediate commodification of the art, and that there's more time spent with the art, especially because people will be coming through for salons, and they'll be bringing themselves into the room instead of simply bringing themselves as a consumer into the room.
It's quite a lot to just invite strangers into your house to come and look at your art collection.
Yes.
How are you going to hang it? Is it going to be in just certain parts of your house? How do you feel about letting people into your home all the time to come and look at your art? Right.
Well, the doors won't be simply open. They're open by appointment. But the salon series and the openings, which are the big parties, they're, of course, by invitation. So there's a sense that, yes, they're strangers, but they're also community, and it's about building that community. Interestingly, I'm interested in breaking down some of the traditional boundaries. So even though the majority of the shows will be in this great open space of the living room, dining room, hall, which is really quite cavernous and given to being a gallery. On the other hand, this first show will actually extend into one of the bedrooms because there's an intimacy about the work that speaks with the bedroom. And I'm interested in extending that experience into those rooms that, like, what happens to a piece of art when you hang it in the bedroom? What happens to a piece of art when you hang it in the bathroom? That it creates a new kind of dialogue and a greater range for how we think about art. So I like the fact that there's going to be a grappling with that. Now, speak to me in a year's time, and I might have created all sorts of boundaries that I don't know I'm going to need.
Right? Do you think differently about how you hang a piece of art in your home when your home's a gallery to where you hang a piece of art in your home as your home?
I think how you hang a show is, of course, different, because it's all about interrelationship. Whereas when you hang something in your home, you know, if somebody is actually building an art collection, then that is about the interrelationship between the pieces. But there's something else going on too, which is it's about the recording of your own life story. So when I look around me, and like I have a photograph of George O'Keeffe on the wall, that it doesn't go with the wider collection that I'm going to actually be showing. That piece of art doesn't just exist according to its aesthetics. It exists for me in terms of its wider stories and associations. And I think that that's always there when somebody chooses to bring a piece of art home, which is actually a part of what I hope to be able to facilitate. That I think that the choosing and the ultimately the buying of art needs to have its story, needs to have its warmth, which is one of the reasons to get away from the storefront, and that it's something that you saw when you came to hear the Ensemble Clem perform, or you had, or Amit Chowdhury read one of his novels, and when you met this amazing person from down the street that you'd never met, that then the art actually starts to carry that story with it.
That was Denison Baldwin-Smith, creative director and founder of the Baldwin Gallery in South London. Find out more about that inaugural exhibition, Mobile Forms, Parisian Abstraction to Amerindian Pop. That opens on November the 4th and is by appointment only. Of course it is. It's in someone's house. We're heading back to the States for our final show today, but one that can be accessed by anyone around the world with a phone. Texas artist Jesse Morgan Barnett is the curator of a new art space that can only be defined by its limits. It is not a physical space to gather. There are no walls on which to hang anything that can be seen. One can only access the exhibitions by picking up the phone and dialing the number 1-800-789-2228. That's 1-800-789-2228. I love commercial radio. Lindsay Connect explains how the phone line gallery has created a new medium for artists and a new way to think about space.
Press 1 to advance through memories. Press pound to move backwards through memories.
The number was passed around press in a Facebook event, like an address. 1-800-789-2228. Anyone who's called since the end of May has heard this recording. The voice giving instructions belongs to Dallas artist Jeff Gibbons, who's known for sculpture and video work. For the phone line, he made an anonymous voicemail bank and asked people to share the first moment they can remember.
My earliest memory is probably of traveling to LA to have Christmas with my dad when I was about 3 or 4 years old. And I remember he had bought me a pair of mittens with little Mickey Mouse appliques on them. When I opened the box, I saw them and I was so excited and I said, "For me?" And he said, "No." And he snatched the box. And I just remember having that sort of joke played on me for that moment. And that's it.
The only tangible thing associated with 1-800-789-2228 is a blue file folder with that number, the name of the gallery, written in red pen on the tab. In the folder are printouts of correspondence between curator Jesse Morgan Barnett and three more artists preparing to make their projects live on the line. Jesse is the co-curator of the Dallas Biennial, but the phone line is his first space to program. He hands me the folder in an empty classroom above the collections at the Modern Museum of Art in Fort Worth, where he's the assistant curator of education, academic programs.
The program that we're using, it's called Telsio, and essentially what it is it provides menu services for businesses to kind of link and connect their customers and employees. So we just repurpose this for the sake of an exhibition kind of format.
The strong concept of phone line piece requires tends to distill the premier interests of any artist who attempts to reach it. For conceptual artist Gary Canone, one of three artists in the forthcoming show, that interest is experimenting with comedy and its awkwardness. I plan to meet Gary at his house on a steep hill, stacked atop another steep hill in the Lincoln Heights neighborhood of Los Angeles. At his kitchen table, Gary tells me about his project Monologue, for which he recorded a string of jokes to be played in a gallery.
For the phone tree project, the 800 number, I'm going to take my growing list of jokes, categorize them, and I will ask a series of questions. Do you want to include political humor? Do you want to include blue material, bodily functions?
Every time people hold a moment of silence, John Cage's estate gets a royalty check.
I have multiple sclerosis. I'm often times in bureaucratic medical phone trees. So recently, Aetna, who's my healthcare provider, my entire history was wiped of meds, and my ability to refill through their website was wiped away. And I went through multiple different phone tree permutations to finally find the person who would bring my history back to me. It led me to think about all those sort of spaces, all those sorts of hierarchies and sub-hierarchies.
Dallas curator and writer Lee Escobedo is particularly interested in the power dynamics of physical space where art is performed and shown. Lee has also used comedy and the work of artists who don't pander to traditional expectations as a way to subvert the preciousness of a physical gallery. Recently, at the prestigious Nasher Sculpture Center, Lee brought rapper Lord Byron and others to challenge the still air of the museum. For his phone line piece, Lee plans to read aloud a review he wrote for theoretical artworks based on the real work of three Dallas artists. That's a relevant approach right now as artists are figuring out how to work around constant interruptions by the city's fire and rescue at smaller venues.
There's a Sturge in Dallas right now, and that Sturge is a Dallas fire marshal, and there's a systematic shutting down of DIY spaces. What if there's a space that was working within the theoretical context and wasn't something you could actually shut down and hear about on Facebook?
There's an urgency in picking up the phone and dialing a number these days. For art historian Lauren Richman and her research, there's nothing more urgent than the United States presidential election November 8th. As an American expat in Berlin, the voting process added to her disoriented feelings.
I had gone through all of the motions, getting the ballot, filling it out, and then I had to find a copy shop locally so that I could print it, as I don't have a printer in my apartment here. I printed out, but it's only printing out 8 of the 13 pages, and I needed that last page, so I spoke with the woman in German, trying my best to communicate that the entire PDF didn't print. She tried to print it again. It came out the same 8 out of 13 pages. Meanwhile, my private ballot with my vote is all over the shop.
Donald Trump's appalling behavior as a contender for president did not exactly blindside Lauren, she says. Brexit caused her, other American expats in the world, to contend with what they once thought impossible. But one thing that at least feels controlled is the ritual of voting. Lauren examined that ritual and asked why we keep it private anyway when so much is at stake.
So I'm asking participants to visit the website that Jesse has developed and record their vote or choose to share that they are not voting in 60 seconds. And in the 60 seconds, they can just simply cast their vote, or they can also share some information about why or why not, or their experience as an expat living abroad.
Lauren says the shift in American national identity, both at home and abroad, calls for a place to meet. And when Halloween gets here, 1-800-789-2228 is the number to call. For Monocle, in Dallas, I'm Lindsay Connect.
Thanks, Lindsay. And you can head to 1-800-789-2228.com to find out about Jesse's most recent exhibitions. And that brings us to the end of today's show. You've been listening to Culture, where my producer was, of course, the premium rate Holly Fisher. Join me again at the same time next week, when we'll be getting ready for Halloween. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bound, and thank you very much for tuning in.